This was not a statement of modesty or fashion. Like everything else she wore, from her blaster to her armor to her other concealed and equally deadly weapons, Zam's veil was a practical implement, used to hide her Claudite features. Claudites were not a trusted species, for obvious reasons. "You know that we failed," Django asked, getting right to the point.
"You told me to kill those in the Naboo starship," Zam said. "I hit the ship, but they used a decoy. Those who were aboard are all dead."
Django fixed her with a smirk and didn't bother to call her words a dodge. "We'll have to try something more subtle this time. My client is getting impatient. There can be no more mistakes." As he finished, he handed Zam a hollow transparent tube containing a pair of whitish centipede-like creatures as long as his forearm. "Cahoons," he explained. "Very poisonous." Zam Wessel lifted the tube to examine the marvelous little murderers more closely, her black eyes sparkling with excitement, and her cheekbones lifting as her mouth widened beneath the veil. She looked back at Django and nodded. Certain that she understood, Django nodded and started around the corner toward his waiting speeder. He paused before stepping in and looked back at his hired assassin. "There can be no mistakes this time," he said. The Claudite saluted, tapping the tube containing the deadly cahoons to her forehead. "Tidy yourself up," Django instructed, and he headed away. Zam Wessel turned back to her own waiting speeder and pulled off her veil. Even as she lifted the cloth, her features began to morph, her mouth tightening, her black eyes sinking back into shapely sockets, and the ridges on her forehead smoothing. In the time it took her to slide her veil into a pocket, she had already assumed a shapely and attractive female human form, with dark and sensuous features. Even her clothing seemed to fit her differently, flowing down gracefully from her face. Off to the side, Django nodded approvingly and sped away. As a Claudite, a changeling, Zam Wessel did bring some advantages to the trade, he had to admit. The vast Jedi Temple sat on a flat plain. Unlike so many of Coruscant's buildings, monuments of efficiency and spare design, this building itself was a work of art, with many ornate columns and soft rounded lines that drew in the eye and held it. Bas-reliefs and statues showed in many areas, with lights set at varying angles to distort the shadows into designs of mystery. Inside, the temple was no different. This was a place of contemplation, a place whose design invited the mind to wander and to explore, a place whose lines themselves asked for interpretation. Art was as much a part of what it was to be a Jedi Knight as was warrior training. Many of the Jedi, past and present, considered art to be a conscious link to the mysteries of the Force. And so the sculptures and portraits that lined every hall were more than mere replicas. They were artistic interpretations of the great Jedi they represented, saying in form alone what the depicted masters might speak in words. Mace Windu and Yoda walked slowly down one polished and decorated corridor, the lights low, but with a brightly illuminated room in the distance before them. "Why couldn't we see this attack on the Senator?" Mace pondered, shaking his head. "This should have been no surprise to the wary, and easy for us to predict."
"Masking the future is this disturbance in the Force," Yoda replied.
The diminutive Jedi seemed tired. Mace understood well the source of that weariness. "The prophecy is coming true. The dark side is growing."
"And only those who have turned to the dark side can sense the possibilities of the future," Yoda said. "Only by probing the dark side can we see."
Mace spent a moment digesting that remark, for what Yoda referred to was no small thing. Not at all. Journeys to the edges of the dark side were not to be taken lightly. Even more dire, the fact that Master Yoda believed that the disturbance all the Jedi had sensed in the Force was so entrenched in the dark side was truly foreboding. "It's been 10 years, and the Sith still have not shown themselves," Mace remarked, daring to say it aloud. The Jedi didn't like to even mention the Sith, their direst of enemies. Many times in the past, the Jedi had dared hope that the Sith had been eradicated, their foul stench cleansed from the galaxy. And so they all would have liked to deny the existence of the mysterious Dark Force users. But they could not. There could be no doubt, and no denying, that the being who had slain Qui-Gon Jinn those 10 years before on Naboo was a Sith Lord. "Do you think the Sith are behind this present disturbance?" Mace dared to ask.
"Out there they are,"
Yoda said with resignation.
"A certainty, that is."
Yoda was referring to the prophecy, of course, that the dark side would rise, and that one would be born who would bring balance to the Force and to the galaxy. Such a potential chosen one was now known among them, and that, too, brought more than a little trepidation to these hallowed halls. "Do you think Obi-Wan's learner will be able to bring balance to the Force?" Mace asked. Yoda stopped walking and slowly turned to regard the other master, his expression showing a range of emotions that reminded Mace that they didn't know what bringing balance to the Force might truly mean.
"Only if he chooses to follow his destiny,"
Yoda replied. And as with Mace's question, the answer hung in the air between them, a spoken belief that could only lead to more uncertainty. Both Yoda and Mace Windu understood the places that some of the Jedi, at least, might have to travel to find the true answers, and those places, emotional stops and not physical, could well test all of them to the very limits of their abilities and sensibilities. They resumed their walk, the only sound the patter of their footsteps. In their ears, though, both Mace and Yoda heard the ominous echo of the diminutive Jedi Master's dire words.
"Only by probing the dark side can we see."
Chapter 8. The door chime was not unexpected. Somehow Padme had known that Anakin would come to speak with her as soon as the opportunity presented itself. She started for the door, but paused, and moved instead to retrieve her robe, aware suddenly that her nightgown was somewhat revealing. Her movements again struck her as curious, though, for never before had Padme Amidala harbored any feelings of modesty. Still, she pulled the robe up tight as she opened the door, finding, predictably, Anakin Skywalker standing before her. "Hello," he said, and it seemed as if he could hardly draw his breath. "Is everything all right?" Anakin stuttered over a response. "Oh, yes," he finally managed to say. "Yes, my master has gone to the lower levels to check on Captain Typho's security measures, but all seems quiet."
"You sound disappointed."
Anakin gave an embarrassed laugh.
"You don't enjoy this," Padme remarked.
"There is nowhere else in all the galaxy I'd rather be," Anakin blurted, and it was Padme's turn to give an embarrassed little laugh.
"But this inertia," she reasoned.
And Anakin nodded as he caught on. "We should be more aggressive in our search for the assassin," he insisted. "To sit back and wait is to invite disaster."
"Master Kenobi does not agree."
"Master Kenobi is bound by the letter of the orders," Anakin explained. "He won't take a chance on doing anything that isn't explicitly asked of him by the Jedi Council." Padme tilted her head and considered this impetuous young man more carefully. Was not discipline a primary lesson of the Jedi Knights? Were they not bound, strictly so, within the structure of the Order and their code?
"Master Kenobi is not like his own master," Anakin said.
"Master Qui-Gon understood the need for independent thinking and initiative. Otherwise, he would have left me on Tatooine."
"And you are more like Master Qui-Gon?" Padme asked.
"I accept the duties I am given, but demand the leeway I need to see them to a proper conclusion."
"Demand?"
Anakin smiled and shrugged. "Well, I ask, at least."
"And presume when you can't get the answers you desire," Padme said with a knowing grin, though in her heart she was only half-teasing. I do the best I can with every problem I am given, was the strongest admission Anakin would offer. And so sitting around guarding me is not your idea of fun. We could do better and more exciting things, Anakin said, and there was a double edge to his voice, one that intrigued Padme and made her pull her robe up even tighter. If we catch the assassin, we might find the root of these attempts, the Padawan explained, quickly putting the discussion back on a professional level. Either way, you will be safer, and our duties will be made far easier. Padme's mind whirled as she tried to sort out Anakin's thoughts and his motivations. He was surprising her with every word, considering that he was a Jedi Padawan, and yet, given the fire that she clearly saw burning behind his blue eyes, he was not surprising her. She saw trouble brewing there, in those simmering and too passionate eyes. But even more than that, she saw excitement and the promise of thrills. And perhaps, the promise of finding out who it was that was trying to kill her. Obi-Wan Kenobi stepped off the turbo lift tentatively, warily, glancing left and right. He noted the two posted guards, alert and ready, and he nodded his approval to them. Every corridor had been like this throughout the massive apartment complex, and in this particular area, above, below, and near Amidala's room, the place was locked down tight. Captain Typho had been given many soldiers at his disposal, and he had situated them well, overseeing as fine a defensive perimeter as Obi-Wan had ever witnessed. The Jedi Master took great comfort in that, of course, and knew that Typho was making his job easier. But Obi-Wan could not relax. He had heard about the attack on the Naboo cruiser in great detail from Typho, and considering the many precautions that had been taken to protect the vessel, everything from broadcasting false entry lanes to the appointed landing pad, to the many shielding fighters, the three accompanying the ship directly, and many more, both Naboo and Republic, covering every conceivable attack lane, these assassins could not be underestimated. They were good, and they were well connected to be sure. And likely, they were stubborn. To get at Senator Amidala through the halls of this building, though, would take an army. Obi-Wan nodded to the guards and walked a circuit of the slower floor, then satisfied, headed back to the turbo lift. Padme took a deep breath, her thoughts lost in the last images of Anakin as he had left her room. Images of her sister Sola flitted about her, almost as if she could hear Sola teasing her already. The senator shook all the thoughts of Sola and particularly of Anakin away and motioned to R2-D2, the little droid standing impassively against the wall beside the door. "Implement the shutdown," she instructed. R2-D2 replied with a fearful, "Go ahead, R2. It's all right. We have protection here." The droid gave another worried call, but extended a probe out to the security panel on the wall beside him. Padme looked back to the door, recalling again the last images of Anakin, her tall and lean Jedi protector. She could see his shining blue eyes as surely as if he was standing before her, full of intensity, watching over her more carefully than any security cam ever could. Anakin stood in the living room of Padme's apartment, absorbing the silence around him, using the lack of physical noise to bolster his mental connection to that more subtle realm of the Force, feeling the life about him as clearly as if his five physical senses were all attuned to it. His eyes were closed, but he could see the region about him clearly enough, could sense any disturbance in the Force. Anakin's eyes popped open wide, his gaze darting about the room, and he pulled his lightsaber from his belt. Or almost did, stopping fast when the door slid open and Master Kenobi walked into the room. Obi-Wan looked about curiously, his gaze settling on Anakin. "Captain Typho has more than enough men downstairs," he said. "No assassin will try that way. Any activity up here?" "Quiet as a tomb," Anakin replied. "I don't like just waiting here for something to happen." Obi-Wan gave a little shake of his head, a movement showing his resignation concerning Anakin's predictability,
and took a view scanner from his belt, checking his screen. His expression, shifting from curious to confused to concerned, spoke volumes to Anakin. He knew that Obi-Wan could see only part of Padme's bedroom, the door area, and R2-D2 standing by the wall, but nothing more. The Jedi Knight's expression asked the question before he even spoke the words. Padme, Senator Amidala covered the cam, the Padawan explained. I don't think she liked me watching her. Obi-Wan's face tensed, and he let out a little growl. What is she thinking? Her security is paramount, and is compromised. She programmed R2 to warn us if there's an intruder, Anakin explained, trying to calm Obi-Wan before his concern could gain any real momentum. It's not an intruder I'm worried about, Obi-Wan countered. Or not merely an intruder. There are many ways to kill a senator. I know, but we also want to catch this assassin, Anakin said, his tone determined, stubborn even. Don't we, Master? You're using her as bait? Obi-Wan asked incredulously, his eyes widening with shock and disbelief. It was her idea, Anakin protested, but his sharp tone showed clearly that he agreed with the plan. Don't worry, no harm will come to her. I can sense everything going on in that room, trust me. It's too risky, Obi-Wan scolded. Besides, your senses aren't that attuned, young Lena. Anakin parsed his words and his tone carefully, trying to sound not defensive, but rather suggestive. And yours are? Obi-Wan could not deny the look of intrigue that crossed his face. Possibly, he admitted. Anakin smiled and nodded, and closed his eyes again, falling into the sensations of the Force, following them to Padme, who was sleeping quietly. He wished that he could see her, could watch the quiet rise and fall of her belly, could hear her soft breathing, could smell the freshness of her hair, could feel the smoothness of her skin, could kiss her and taste the sweetness of her lips. He had to settle for this, for feeling her life energy in the Force. A place of warmth it was. In a different way, Padme was thinking of Anakin as well. He was there beside her, in her dreams. She saw the fighting match that she knew would soon ensue in the Senate. The screaming and fist-waving, the threats and the loud objections. How badly it drained her. Anakin was there. Her dream became a nightmare. Some unseen assassin chasing her, blaster bolts whipping past her, and her feet seemed as if they were stuck in deep mud. But Anakin rushed past, his lightsaber ignited and waving, deflecting the blaster bolts aside. Padme shifted a bit and gave a little groan. On many levels, as uncomfortable with the identity of a rescuer as she was with the presence of the assassin. She didn't truly awaken, though, just thrashed a bit and raised her head, opening her eyes only briefly before burying her face in her pillow. She didn't see the small round droid hovering behind the blinds outside her window. She didn't see the appendages come out of it, attaching to the window, or the sparks arcing about those arms as the droid shut down the security system. She didn't see the larger arm deploy, cutting a hole in the glass, nor did she hear the slight faint sound as the glass was removed. Over by the door in Padme's room, R2-D2's lights went on. The droid's domed head swiveled about, scanning the room, and he gave a soft... But then, apparently detecting nothing amiss, the droid shut back down. Outside, a small tube came forth from the probe droid, moving to the hole in the window, and crawling through it, into Padme's room, came a pair of Kuhoons, like bloated white maggots with lines of black legs along their sides, and nasty mandibles. Dangerous as those mandibles looked, though, the true danger of the Kuhoons lay at the other end, the tail stinger, dripping of venom. The vicious Kuhoons crawled in through the blinds and started immediately toward the bed and the sleeping woman. You look tired, Obi-Wan said to Anakin in the adjoining room. The Padawan, still standing, opened his eyes and came out of his meditative trance. He took a moment to register the words, and then gave a little shrug, not disagreeing. I don't sleep well anymore. That was hardly news to Obi-Wan. Because of your mother? He asked. I don't know why I keep dreaming about her now, Anakin answered, frustration coming through in his voice. I haven't seen her since I was little. Your love for her was, and remains, deep, Obi-Wan said. That is hardly reason for despair. But these are more than... Anakin started to say, but he stopped and sighed and shook his head. Are they dreams, or are they visions? Are they images of what has been, or do they tell of something that is yet to be? Or are they just dreams? Obi-Wan said, his gentle smile showing through his scraggly beard. Not every dream is a premonition, some vision or some mystical connection. Some dreams are just dreams. And even Jedi have dreams, young Padawan. Anakin didn't seem very satisfied with that. He just shook his head again. Dreams pass in time, Obi-Wan told him. I'd rather dream of Padme, Anakin replied with a sly smile. Just being around her again is intoxicating. Obi-Wan's sudden frown erased both his and Anakin's smiles. Mind your thoughts, Anakin, he scolded in no uncertain tone. They betray you. You've made a commitment to the Jedi Order, a commitment not easily broken, and the Jedi stand on such relationships is uncompromising. Attachment is forbidden. He gave a little derisive snort and looked toward the sleeping senator's room. And don't forget that she's a politician. They're not to be trusted. She's not like the others in the Senate, Master, Anakin protested strongly. Obi-Wan eyed him carefully. It's been my experience that senators focus only on pleasing those who fund their campaigns, and they are more than willing to forget the niceties of democracy to get those funds. Not another lecture, Master, Anakin said with a profound sigh. He had heard this particular diatribe repeatedly. At least not on the economics of politics. Obi-Wan was no fan of the politics of the Republic. He started speaking again, or tried to, but Anakin abruptly interrupted. Please, Master, he said emphatically. Besides, you're generalizing. I know that Padme, Senator Amidala, Obi-Wan sternly corrected. Isn't like that, Anakin finished. And the Chancellor doesn't seem to be corrupt. Palpatine's a politician. I've observed that he is very clever at following the passions and prejudices of the Senators. I think he is a good man, Anakin stated. My instincts are very positive about... The young Padawan trailed off, his eyes widening, his expression becoming one of shock. I sense it too, Obi-Wan said breathlessly. And the two Jedi exploded into motion. Inside the bedroom, the Cahoons crawled slowly and deliberately toward the sleeping Padme's exposed neck and face, their mandibles clicking excitedly. R2-D2 shrieked, catching on to the threat. The droid tootled a series of alarms and focused a light on the bed, highlighting the centipede invaders perfectly as Obi-Wan and Anakin burst into the room. Padme awoke, her eyes going wide, sucking in her breath in terror as the wicked little creature stood up and hissed and came at her. Or would have, except that Anakin was there. His blue lightsaber blade slashing across, just above the bed covers, once and again slicing both creatures in half. Droid! Obi-Wan cried, and Anakin and Padme turned to see him rushing for the window. There, hovering outside, was the remote assassin, its appendages retracting fast. Obi-Wan leapt into the blinds, taking them with him right through the window, shattering the glass. He reached into the Force as he leapt, using it to extend his jump to send him far through the air to catch hold of the retreating droid assassin. With its added weight, the floating droid sank considerably, but it compensated and stabilized quickly, leaving the Jedi hanging onto it 100 stories up. Off flew the droid, taking Obi-Wan with it. Anakin?
Padme asked, turning to him. When she saw him return the look, and saw the sudden flicker of intensity in his blue eyes, she pulled her nitrous higher about her shoulders.
Stay here, Anakin instructed. Watch your R2.
He rushed for the door, only to stop abruptly as Captain Typho and a pair of guards, along with the handmaiden Dorme, charged in.
See to her,
was all that Anakin explained, as he scrambled past them, running full out for the turbo lifts. Not without defensive systems, the probe droid repeatedly sent electrical shocks arcing over its surface, stinging Obi-Wan's hands. The Jedi Knight gritted through the pain, having no alternative but to hold on. He knew he shouldn't look down, but he did so anyway to see the city teeming far, far below. Another shock nearly sent him plummeting toward that distant bustle. Reflexively, and hardly considering all the implications, the Jedi fumbled with one hand, found a power wire, and pulled it free, ceasing the electrical shocks. But ending, too, the power that kept the probe droid aloft. Down they went, falling like stones, the lights of the various floors flashing past them like strobes as they dropped.
Not good, not good,
Obi-Wan said over and over as he worked frantically to reconnect the wire. Finally, he got it. The probe droid's lights blinked back on, and off the remote soared, with Obi-Wan hanging on desperately. The droid wasted no time in reigniting the series of electrical shocks, stinging the Jedi, but not shaking the stubborn man free. Anakin was in no mood to wait for a turbo lift. Out came his lightsaber, and with a single, well-placed thrust, the Padawan had the doors open, though the turbo lift car was nowhere near his floor. Anakin didn't even pause long enough to discern if it was above him or below. He just leapt into the shaft, catching hold of one of the supporting poles within with one arm, propping the side of his foot tight against it and spinning downward. His mind whirled, trying to remember the layout of the building and which levels held the various docking bays. Suddenly, that sixth sense, feeling through the Force, alerted him to danger. Yikes! He yelled as he looked down to see the turbo lift racing up at him. Grabbing on tighter to the pole, he held his open palm downward, then sent a tremendous force push below, not to stop the lift, but to propel himself back up the shaft, keeping him ahead of the lift with sufficient speed for him to reorient himself and land, sprawled atop the speeding car. Again, whipping out his lightsaber, he stabbed it through the catch in the lift's top hatch. Ignoring the shrieks from the car's occupants below, Anakin pulled open the hatch, grabbed the edge as he shut off his blade, then somersaulted into the car.
Docking bay level?
He asked the pair of stunned senators, a Sulistan and a human.
47,
the human responded at once.
Too late,
the Sulistan added, noting the rolling floor numbers. The diminutive senator started to add.
Next is 60-something.
But Anakin slammed the brake button. And when that didn't work fast enough for him, he reached into the Force again and grabbed at the braking mechanisms, forcing them even more tightly into place. All three went off the floor with a sudden stop, the Sulistan landing hard. Anakin banged on the door, yelling for it to open. A hand on his shoulder slowed him, and he turned to see the human senator step by, one finger held up in a gesture, bidding the eager young Jedi to wait. The senator pushed a button, clearly marked on the panel, and the turbolift door slid open. With a shrug and a sheepish smile, Anakin had to fall to his belly and squeeze through the opening that dropped to the hallway below. He ran frantically, left and then right, finally spotting a balcony adjacent to the parking garage. Out he ran, then vaulted over a rail, dropping to a line of parked speeders. One yellow snub-nosed speeder was open, so he jumped in, firing it up, and zooming away, off the platform and then up, up, heading for the line of traffic flowing high above. He tried to get his bearings as he rose. What side of the building was he now on? And which side had Obi-Wan flown away from? And what angle had the fleeing probe droid taken? As he tried to sort it all out, Anakin realized that only one of two things could possibly put him on Obi-Wan's trail. Dumb luck. Or... The Padawan fell into the Force yet again, searching for the sensation that he could identify as his Jedi Master. Zam Wesso leaned against the side of her speeder, impatiently tapping her gloved fingers on the roof of the old vehicle. She wore an oversized purple helmet, front-wedged and solid, save a small rectangle cut out about her eyes. But while that hid her assumed beauty, her form-fitting grav suit showed every feminine curve. Zam didn't think much about it at that time, though, for with this particular mission, it was more important that she merely blend in. Often she had taken assignments where her assumed feminine wiles had helped her tremendously, where she had played upon the obvious weakness of a male to get close. Those wiles weren't going to help her with this assignment, though, and Zam knew it. This time, she was out to kill a woman, a senator, and one who was very well guarded by beings absolutely devoted to her, as protective of her as a parent might be to a child. Zam wondered what this woman might have done to so invoke the wrath of her employers. Or at least, she started to wonder, as she had started to wonder several times since Django had hired her to kill the senator. The professional assassin never truly let her thoughts travel down that path. It wasn't her business. She was not a moral gauge for anyone, not one to decide the value of her assignment or the justice or injustice involved. She was just a tool, in many ways, a machine. She was the extension of her employers, and nothing more. Django had bade her to kill Amidala, and so she would kill Amidala, fly back and collect her due, and go on to the next assignment. It was clean, and it was simple. Zam could hardly believe that the explosive charge she had managed to hide on the landing platform had not done the job. But she had taken that lesson to heart, had come to understand that the weaknesses of Senator Amidala were not easily discerned and exploited. The changeling banged her fist on the roof of the speeder. She hated that she had been forced to go outside for help, to procure a probe droid to do the task that she so relished handling personally. But now there were Jedi about Amidala, by all the rumors, and Zam had little desire to do battle with one of those troublesome fanatics. She glanced into the speeder, to the timepiece on the console, and nodded grimly. The job should be completed by now. The poisonous cocoons had been delivered, likely, and one scratch of a venomous stinger should be more than enough. Zam stood up straight, sensing something, some sudden feeling of uneasiness. She heard a cry of surprise or of fear, and she glanced all about. And then her eyes, within the cutout rectangle of the helmet, went wide indeed. She watched in blank amazement as the probe droid, her programmed assassin, wove through the towering buildings of Coruscant, with a man dressed like a Jedi hanging onto it. Zam's fear lessened, and her smile widened, though, as she watched the droid go into defensive action, for this one was well-programmed. It smacked against the side of a building, nearly dislodging the Jedi, and when that didn't work, the clever droid dove back into the traffic lane, soaring behind a speeder just above the vehicle's exhaust. The Jedi squirmed and tucked and somehow managed to keep himself out of that fiery exhaust, and so the droid swooped off to the side, taking a different tack. It flew in low over the top of one building. Zam's eyes widened as she watched the spectacle. She was impressed at the way the Jedi did not allow himself to be slammed off, but rather tucked his legs enough to run along the rooftop as the droid skimmed across it. Oh, he was good. This was truly entertaining to the confident bounty hunter. But enough was enough. Zam reached into the speeder and pulled out a long blaster rifle, casually lifting and leveling. She fired off a series of shots, and explosions ignited all about the Jedi and the droid. Zam looked up from her sights, stunned to see that the crafty man had somehow avoided those shots, had dodged, or had, she mused, used his Jedi powers to deflect them. "Block this," the bounty hunter said, raising the rifle again. Taking aim at the Jedi's chest, she lifted the barrel just a bit and squeezed the trigger. The probe droid exploded. The Jedi plummeted from sight. Zam sighed and shrugged, telling herself that the cost of the probe droid was worth the show. And hopefully the victory. If Senator Amidala lay dead in her room, then that cost would be a minor thing indeed. For this bounty exceeded anything Zam had ever hoped to collect. The bounty hunter slipped her rifle back into her speeder, then bent low and squeezed in, soaring off into the Coruscant traffic lanes. Obi-Wan screamed as he dropped. 10 stories. 20. There was nothing in his Jedi repertoire to save him this time. He looked all about frantically, but there was nothing. No handholds, no platform, no awning of thick and padded cloth. Nothing. Just another 500 stories to the ground. He tried to find a sense of calm, tried to fall into the Force and accept this unwelcomed end. And then a speeder swooped beside him, and he saw that cocky smile of his unruly Padawan, and never in his life had Obi-Wan Kenobi been happier to see anything.
"Hitchhikers usually stand on the platforms," Anakin informed him, and he swooped the speeder near enough for Obi-Wan to grab on. "A novel approach, though. Gets the attention of passing traffic."
Obi-Wan was too busy clawing his way into the passenger seat to offer a retort. He finally settled in next to Anakin. "I almost lost you there," the Padawan remarked.
"No kidding. What took you so long?"
Anakin eased back in his seat, putting his left arm up on the door of the open speeder and assuming a casual posture.
"Oh, you know, Master," he said flippantly. "I couldn't find a speeder I really liked. One with an open cockpit, of course, and with the right speed capabilities to catch your droid scooter. And then, you know, I had to hold out for just the right color."
"There!"
Obi-Wan shouted, pointing up to a closed-in speeder, recognizing it as the one behind the assassin who had been shooting at him. It soared above them, and Anakin cut hard on the wheel and the stick, angling in fast pursuit. Almost immediately, an arm came out of the lead speeder's open window, holding a blaster pistol, and the bounty hunter squeezed off a series of shots.
"If you'd spend as much time working on your lightsaber skills as you do on your wit, young Padawan, you would rival Master Yoda,"
Obi-Wan said. And he ducked, getting jostled about, as Anakin cut a series of evasive turns.
"I thought I already did."
"Only in your mind, my very young Padawan," Obi-Wan retorted. He gave a little cry and ducked reflexively as Anakin dived in and out of traffic, narrowly missing several vehicles.
"Careful! Hey, easy! You know I don't like it when you do that." "Sorry, I forgot you don't like flying, Master," Anakin said,
his voice rising at the end as he took the speeder down suddenly to avoid another blaster bolt from the stubborn bounty hunter.
"I don't mind flying," Obi-Wan insisted, "but what you're doing is suicide."
His words nearly caught in his throat, along with his stomach, as Anakin cut hard to the right, then dropped suddenly, punched the throttle, pulled back to the left, and lifted the nose, zipping the speeder up through the traffic lane and back in sight of the bounty hunter, only to see another line of blaster bolts coming at him. Then the bounty hunter dived to the side suddenly, and both Jedi opened their eyes and their mouths wide, their screams drowned out by a commuter train crossing right in front of them. Obi-Wan tasted bile again, but somehow Anakin managed to avoid the train coming out the other side. Obi-Wan looked over to his Padawan to see him assuming a casual, in-control posture.
"Master, you know I've been flying since before I could walk," Anakin said with a sly grin. "I'm very good at this."
"Just slow down," Obi-Wan instructed,
in a voice that suggested the dignified Jedi Knight was about to throw up. Anakin ignored him, taking the speeder in fast pursuit of the assassin, right into a line of giant trucks. Around and around they went, cutting fast corners through the traffic, over the traffic, under the traffic, and around the buildings, always keeping the assassin's speeder in sight. Anakin took his craft right up on edge, skimming the side of one building.
"He can't lose me," the Padawan boasted. "He's getting desperate."
"Great,"
Obi-Wan answered dryly.
"Oh, wait,"
Obi-Wan added, when the speeder in front dived into a tram tunnel.
"Don't go in there."
But Anakin zoomed right in and then zoomed right back out, a huge rushing train chasing him, and Obi-Wan screaming about as loudly as the train was blowing its horn.
"You know I don't like it when you do that!" Sorry, Master, Anakin answered unconvincingly. Don't worry. This guy's gonna kill himself any minute now.
Well, let him do that alone,
Obi-Wan insisted. They watched as the assassin zoomed right into traffic, soaring the wrong way down a congested lane. Anakin went in right behind. Both speeders zigged and zagged wildly, frantically, the occasional blaster bolt shooting back from the lead one. And then, suddenly, the assassin cut fast, straight up, a tight loop that brought Zam behind the two Jedi. Great move, Anakin congratulated. I got one, too. He slammed on his brakes, reversing thrust, and the assassin's speeder flashed up right beside them. And there was the assassin, firing point-blank at Obi-Wan.
What are you doing?
Obi-Wan demanded.
He's going to blast me!
Right, Anakin agreed, working frantically to maneuver away.
This isn't working. Nice of you to notice.
Obi-Wan dodged, then lurched as the speeder dropped suddenly, Anakin taking it right under the assassins.
He can't shoot us down here,
the Padawan congratulated himself. But his smile lasted only the split second it took for their opponent's new tactic to register. The assassin swerved out of the traffic lane and shot straight for a building, coming in at an angle to just skim the rooftop. Obi-Wan started to shout out Anakin's name, but the word came out as,
"Ananana!"
The Padawan was in control, though, and he slowed and lifted his speeder's nose just up over the edge of the rooftop. Another obstacle showed itself almost immediately. A large craft coming in low and slow.
It's landing! Obi-Wan shouted.
And when Anakin didn't immediately respond, he added desperately,
On us!
It came out,
On us!
As Anakin brought the speeder up on edge and zipped around a corner, clipping a flagpole and taking its cloth contents free.
Clear that!
The seemingly unshakable Padawan said, nodding down to the torn flag, which had caught itself in one of the speeder's front air scoops.
What? Clear the flag! We're losing power! Hurry!
Complaining under his breath with every movement, Obi-Wan crawled out of the cockpit and gingerly onto the front engine. He bent low and tugged the flag free, and the speeder lurched forward, nearly dislodging him.
Don't do that! He screamed. I don't like it when you do that!
So sorry, Master.
He's heading for the power refinery, Obi-Wan said. But take it easy. It's dangerous near those power couplings.
Anakin zoomed right past one of the couplings, and a huge electrical bolt had the air crackling all about them.
Slow down, Obi-Wan ordered. Slow down! Don't go through there!
But Anakin did just that, banking left, right, left.
What are you doing?
Sorry, Master!
More bolts crackled all about them. Right, left, right again, up and over, down and around, and somehow, incredibly, out the other side.
Whoa, that was good, Obi-Wan admitted. That was crazy,
the rattled Anakin corrected. The older Jedi snapped a glare at him, recognized the greenish color that had suddenly come to the Padawan's face, and then just put his head in his hands and groaned.
Got him now, Anakin announced.
The assassin was sliding his speeder sidelong around a corner between two buildings up ahead. Anakin went right around behind, only to find the lead speeder stopped and blocking the alleyway. The assassin leaning out the door, blaster pistol leveled.
Ah, blast,
Padawan remarked.
Stop,
Obi-Wan told him, and both ducked as a line of bolts came at them.
No, we can make it,
Anakin insisted, punching the throttle. He dived a speeder under the assassin's, barely missing it, then went up on edge, slipping through a small gap in the building. But there were pipes there, and no level of flying could put the speeder safely through them. They bounced sidelong, then flipped end over end, narrowly missing a giant crane and clipping some struts. The damage brought forth a giant fiery gas ball, nearly immolating them, and in the uncontrolled spin that followed, they bounced off yet another building, and the speeder stalled out. Anakin winced, expected a line of curses to come at him, but when he finally looked at Obi-Wan, he saw the Jedi staring straight ahead, eyes wide and unblinking, and saying,
I'm crazy. I'm crazy. I'm crazy.
Over and over again.
But it worked, Anakin dared to say. We made it! It didn't work!
Obi-Wan yelled at him.
We've stalled! And you almost got us killed!
Anakin looked down at his hands and body and waggled his fingers.
I think we're still alive.
He grinned, trying to disarm his fuming master, but Obi-Wan seemed as if he was about to explode.
It was stupid, he roared.
Anakin worked wildly, trying to restart the speeder. I could have made it, he protested sheepishly. His confident expression strengthened as the speeder roared back to life.
But you didn't, and now we've lost him.
Even as Obi-Wan finished, a barrage of laser bolts rained down on them, setting off explosions that rocked them back and forth. The pair looked up to see the assassin zooming away.
No, we didn't, a smiling Anakin said.
He took the speeder up, the sudden thrust violently throwing them both back in their seats. They came through the area of smoke and carnage with several small fires burning on their speeder. Obi-Wan slapped at flames in the control panel. Again, they chased the assassin into the main travel lanes, dodging and turning fast about incoming traffic. Up ahead, the assassin cut fast to the left, between two buildings, and Anakin responded, going right and up.
Where are you going?
A perplexed Obi-Wan asked.
He went down there, the other way.
This is a shortcut, I think.
What do you mean, you think? What kind of shortcut? He went completely the other way. You've lost him.
Master, if we keep this chase going, that creep's gonna end up deep-fried, Anakin tried to explain.
Personally, I'd very much like to find out who he is and who he's working for.
Oh, Obi-Wan replied, his voice dripping with sarcasm. So that's why we're going in the wrong direction.
Anakin took them up and around, finally settling into a hover some 50 stories up from the street.
Well, you lost him, Obi-Wan said.
I'm deeply sorry, Master, Anakin replied.
Again, he seemed hardly convincing, as if he was saying just what he had to say to keep Obi-Wan from scolding him further. The Jedi Knight looked at him hard, ready to call him on it, when he noticed that Anakin, seemingly deep in concentration, was counting softly.
Excuse me for a moment, the Padawan said.
He stood up, and to Obi-Wan's complete shock, stepped out of the speeder. Obi-Wan lurched over to the edge and stared down, watching Anakin drop about 5 stories before landing atop the roof of a familiar speeder that was zooming beneath them.
I hate it when he does that, Obi-Wan muttered incredulously, shaking his head.
Zam Wessel skimmed close to the buildings, staying to the side of the main traffic lanes. She didn't know whether the probe droid had successfully completed its mission, but she was feeling pretty good at that moment, having outwitted a pair of Jedi. Suddenly, her speeder shook hard. At first, she thought she had been hit by a blaster bolt, but then, surveying for damage, she came to know the truth of the missile, and to know that it, that he, had somehow landed on her speeder. Zam backed off on the throttle, then slammed it out full, lurching the craft ahead. The force of the sudden acceleration nearly dislodged Anakin, sending him sliding back to the tail, but he hung on stubbornly, and to Zam's dismay, even began crawling back toward the cockpit. With a sneer, Zam hit the brakes hard, and Anakin went sliding and bouncing past her. But the stubborn young Jedi caught one of the twin front forks of the speeder and hung on yet again. Zam accelerated and reached out her blaster pistol, letting fly a series of bolts in Anakin's general direction. The angle was wrong, though, and she couldn't score any hits. And there he was, crawling back stubbornly toward the roof, despite all of Zam's evasive maneuvers. Her clawed-like form came back suddenly and briefly, as she lost concentration, but she recovered quickly. The bounty hunter cursed under her breath and swooped back into traffic, trying to formulate some plan for ridding herself of the troublesome Jedi. She went back into her evasive traffic-dodging maneuvers yet again, entertaining the thought of moving in close to some of the heavier traffic and letting the exhaust plume smoke the fool atop her craft. She had almost convinced herself to do just that
when suddenly a glowing blue blade of energy sheared through the top of her speeder and plunged down beside her. She looked up to see the stubborn young Jedi cutting through the roof. Swerving all about, she fired off a shot at him, then another. Finally, to her relief, a shot took the lightsaber from his hand, though whether she had taken the hand as well, or just the weapon, she could not tell. Obi-Wan had finally caught sight of Zam's speeder, with Anakin scrambling atop it, when the lightsaber tumbled from the Padawan's grasp. Obi-Wan gave a shake of his head and dived his speeder toward the street, angling for an interception. Anakin's hand plunged through the hole in the roof, and Zam lifted her blaster pistol in his direction. He didn't reach for her, just held his hand there, outstretched, and before she could fire, some unseen force yanked the pistol from her hand, throwing it right into the Jedi's grasp.
No!
The bounty hunter yelled, gasping in astonishment. She lurched in her seat, letting go of her speeder's controls to grab the pistol desperately with both hands. The pair struggled over the weapon, the speeder dipping right and left. And then the pistol went off, hitting neither opponent, but blowing a hole in the flooring of Zam's speeder, cutting some control pipes in the process. The speeder careened out of control, and Zam fell back, over the controls desperately but futilely. They dived and spun sidelong and head over. Screaming, both hung on for dear life as they spiraled toward the street. Finally, at the last possible second, Zam gained some control, enough to turn the impending crash into a spark-throwing skid along the broken permacrete of the seedy section of Coruscant's belly. The speeder bounced up on edge and slammed to a halt, and Anakin went flying, tumbling along the street for a long, long way. When he finally got control, he saw the assassin leaping from the speeder and running down the street, so he climbed back to his feet and started to follow. The splash, as he stepped in one dirty puddle, woke Anakin to the harsh realities about him. This was the underbelly of Coruscant, the smelly and dirty streets. He slowed, the assassin was out of sight anyway, and looked about curiously, noting the many lowlifes, mostly non-humans of quite a variety of species. The Padawan crinkled his nose in surprise and incredulity to see beings panhandling up and down the street. He shook it all away quickly, though, reminding himself of the real reason he was here, and of Padme and her need for security. Spurred by images of the beautiful senator from Naboo, the young Jedi sprinted along the broken sidewalk, catching sight of the assassin moving through a crowd of ruffians. Anakin charged, right in behind, pushing and shoving, but making little headway against the press. He spotted the assassin at the last second before the helmeted killer disappeared through a doorway. Anakin shoved through, finally, and glanced up to see the glare of the gambling sign above the establishment. Undaunted, he started again for the door, and then stopped as he heard Obi-Wan calling. A familiar yellow speeder dropped to a resting place on the side of the street. Anakin! Obi-Wan walked toward the young Jedi, pointedly holding Anakin's dropped lightsaber in his hand. She went into that club, Master. Obi-Wan patted his hand in the air to calm the Padawan, not even registering Anakin's surprising use of the feminine pronoun. Patience, he said. Use the Force, Anakin. Think. Sorry, Master. He went in there to hide, not run, Obi-Wan reasoned. Yes, Master. Obi-Wan held the lightsaber out toward his student. Next time, try not to lose it. Sorry, Master. Obi-Wan pulled the precious weapon back as Anakin reached for it, and held the young Padawan's gaze with his own stern look. A Jedi's lightsaber is his most precious possession. Yes, Master. Again, Anakin reached for the lightsaber, and again Obi-Wan pulled it back, never letting Anakin go from his scrutinizing stare. He must keep it with him at all times. I know, Master, Anakin replied, a bit of exasperation creeping into his tone. This weapon is your life. I've heard this lesson before. Obi-Wan held it out again, finally relinquishing that awful stare, and Anakin took the weapon and replaced it on his belt. But you haven't learned anything, Anakin, the Jedi Knight said, turning away. I try, Master. There was sincerity in his tone, Obi-Wan clearly recognized, and a bit of regret, perhaps. And that reminded Obi-Wan of the difficult circumstances under which Anakin had entered the Order. He had been far too old, nearly 10 years of age, and Master Qui-Gon had taken him in without permission, without the blessing of the Jedi Council.
Master Yoda had seen potential danger in young Anakin Skywalker. No one they had ever encountered had been stronger with the Force, in terms of sheer potential. But the Jedi Order normally required training from the earliest possible age. The Force was too powerful a tool. No, not a tool. And that was the problem. An unwise Jedi might consider the Force a tool, a means to his own ends. But a true Jedi understood that the Force was a partner on a concurrent course, a common pathway to true harmony and understanding. After Qui-Gon's death at the hands of a Sith Lord, the Jedi Council had rethought their decision about young Anakin and had allowed his training to go forward, with Obi-Wan fulfilling his promise to Qui-Gon that he would take the talented young boy under his tutelage. The Council had been hesitant, though, and obviously not happy about it. Yoda had seemed almost resigned, as if this path was one that they could not deny, rather than one they would willingly and eagerly walk. For the whispers spoke of Anakin as the Chosen One, the one who would bring balance to the Force. Obi-Wan wasn't sure what that meant, and he was more than a little fearful. He looked up at Anakin, who was standing patiently, properly subdued after the tongue-lashing, and he took comfort in that image, in this incredibly likable, somewhat stubborn, and obviously brash young man. He hid his smile, only because it would not do for Anakin to understand himself forgiven so easily for his rash actions and the loss of his weapon. Obi-Wan had to disguise a chuckle as a cough. After all, hadn't he been the one who had leapt out through a window 100 stories above the streets of Coruscant? The Jedi Knight led the way into the gambling club. Humans and non-humans mingled about in the smoky air, sipping drinks of every color and puffing on exotic pipes full of exotic plants. Many robes showed bulges reminiscent of weapons, and in looking around, both Jedi understood that everyone was a potential threat. "Why do I think that you're going to be the death of me?" Obi-Wan commented above the clamor. "Don't say that, Master," Anakin replied seriously, and the intensity of his tone surprised Obi-Wan. "You're the closest thing I have to a father. I love you, and I don't want to cause you pain." "Then why don't you listen to me?" "I will," Anakin said eagerly. "I'll do better, I promise. Obi-Wan nodded and glanced all around. "Do you see him?" "I think he's a she." "Then be extra careful," Obi-Wan said, and he gave a snort. "And I think she's a changeling," Anakin added. Obi-Wan nodded to the crowd ahead of them. "Go and find her." He started the opposite way. "Where are you going, Master?" "To get a drink," came the short response. Anakin blinked in surprise to see his master heading for the bar. He almost started after, to inquire further, but he recalled the scolding he had just received and his promise to do better, to obey his master. He turned and started away, milling through the crowd, trying to hold his calm against the wave of faces staring at him, most with obvious suspicion, some even openly hostile. Over at the bar, Obi-Wan watched him for a bit, out of the corner of his eye. He signaled to the bartender, then watched as a glass was placed in front of him and amber liquid poured in.
"Wanna buy some death sticks?" came a guttural voice from the side.
Obi-Wan didn't even turn to fully regard the speaker, who wore a wild mane of black hair, 2 antennae twirled up from his hair like curly horns.
"Nobody's got better death sticks than Elon Sleazebagano,"
the ruffian added, with a perfectly evil smile. "You don't want to sell me death sticks," the Jedi coolly said, waggling his fingers slightly, bringing the weight of the Force into his voice.
"I don't want to sell you death sticks,"
Elon Sleazebagano obediently repeated. Again, the Jedi waggled his fingers. "You want to go home and rethink your life."
"I want to go home and rethink my life,"
Elon readily agreed, and he turned and walked away. Obi-Wan tossed back his drink and motioned for the bartender to fill it up. A short distance away, walking among the crowd, Anakin continued his scan. Something didn't seem quite right to him, but of course, how could he expect it to in this seedy place? Still, some sensation nagged at him. Some mounting evil that seemed above the level expected even in here. He didn't actually see the blaster pistol coming out of the holster, didn't see it rising up toward the apparently unsuspecting Obi-Wan's back. But he felt. Anakin spun as Obi-Wan spun, to see his master coming around, lightsaber igniting, in a beautiful and graceful turn with perfect balance. It seemed almost as if in slow motion to Anakin. Though, of course, Obi-Wan was moving with deadly speed and precision, as his blade, blue like Anakin's, cut a short vertical loop, and then a second, reaching farther out toward his foe. The would-be assassin, and he could see clearly now that it was a woman, since she had taken off her helmet, shrieked in agony as her arm, still clutching the blaster, fell free to the floor, sheared off above the elbow. The room exploded into motion, with Anakin rushing to Obi-Wan's side, club patrons leaping up all about them, bristling with nervous energy. "Easy," Anakin said loudly, patting his hands in the air, imbuing his voice with the strength of the Force. "Official business. Go back to your drinks." Gradually, very gradually, the club resumed its previous atmosphere, with conversations beginning again. Seeming hardly concerned, Obi-Wan motioned for Anakin to help him, and together they helped the assassin out to the street. They lowered her gently to the ground, and she started awake as soon as Obi-Wan began to attend her wounded arm. She growled ferally and winced in agony, all the while staring up hatefully at the two Jedi. "Do you know who it was you were trying to kill?" Obi-Wan asked her.
"The senator from Naboo,"
Zam Wessel said matter-of-factly, as if it hardly mattered. "Who hired you?" Her answer was a glare.
"It was just a job."
"Tell us," Anakin demanded, coming forward threateningly. The tough bounty hunter didn't even flinch.
"The senator's going to die soon anyway," she said. "It won't end with me. For the price they're offering, there'll be bounty hunters lining up to take the hit. And the next one won't make the same mistake I did."
Tough as she was, she ended with a grunt and a groan. "This wound's going to need more treatment than I can give it here," an obviously concerned Obi-Wan explained to Anakin. But if the younger man even cared, he didn't show it. His expression angry, he came forward.
"Who hired you?"
he asked again. And then he continued, throwing the full weight of the Force into his demand, a strength that surprised Obi-Wan, that came from something more than prudence or dedication to his current job.
"Tell us! Tell us now!"
The bounty hunter continued to glare at him, but lips twitching, she started to answer.
"It was a bounty hunter called..."
They heard a puff from above, and the bounty hunter twitched and gasped, and simply expired, her human female features twisting grotesquely back into the lumpy form of her true Claudite nature. Anakin and Obi-Wan tore their eyes away from the spectacle to look up, and heard the roar as they watched an armored rocket man lift away into the Coruscant night, disappearing into the sky. Obi-Wan looked back to the dead creature and pulled a small item from her neck, holding it up for Anakin to see.
"Toxic dot."
Anakin sighed and looked away. So they had foiled this attempt and killed one assassin. But it was clear to him that Senator Amidala, Padme, remained in grave danger. Chapter 9. Anakin stood quietly in the Jedi Council Chamber, encircled by the Masters of the Order. Beside him stood Obi-Wan, his master, but not one of the Masters. Obi-Wan, like the majority of the 10,000 Jedi, was a knight. But these select few, sitting around the edges of the room, were masters, the highest-ranking members of the Order. Anakin had never been comfortable in this esteemed company. He knew that more than half of the Jedi Masters sitting here had expressed grave doubts about allowing him into the Order at the advanced age of 10. He knew that even after Yoda had swayed the vote to allow him to begin studying under Obi-Wan, a few continued to hold those doubts.
"Track down this bounty hunter, you must, Obi-Wan,"
Master Yoda said, as the others passed the toxic dart about.
"Most importantly, find out who he's working for," Mace Windu added.
"What about Senator Amidala?" Obi-Wan asked. "She will still need protecting." Anakin, anticipating what might be coming, straightened as Yoda turned his gaze his way.
Handle that, your Padawan will.
Anakin felt his heart soar at Yoda's declaration, both because of the confidence obviously being shown in him, and also because this was one assignment he knew that he would truly enjoy.
Anakin, escort the senator back to her home planet of Naboo, Mace added. She'll be safer there. And don't use registered transport. Travel as refugees.
Anakin nodded as the assignment was explained, but he knew immediately that there would be a few obstacles to such a course. As the leader of the opposition to the Military Creation Act, it will be very difficult to get Senator Amidala to leave the capital.
Until caught, this killer is. Our judgment she must respect,
Yoda replied. Anakin nodded. But I know how deeply she cares about this upcoming vote, Master, he replied. She is more concerned with defeating the Act than with—
Anakin, Mace interrupted. Go to the Senate and ask Chancellor Palpatine to speak with her.
The tone of his voice made it clear that they had spent enough time on these issues. The Jedi Knight and his Padawan had their assignments, and Yoda dismissed them with a nod. Anakin was not nervous in the office of Chancellor Palpatine. Certainly he understood the man's power, and certainly he respected the office itself, but for some reason the young Padawan felt very comfortable here. Felt as if he was with a friend. He hadn't spent much time with Palpatine, but on those few occasions when he had spoken with the man privately, he had always felt as if the Supreme Chancellor was taking an honest interest in him. In some ways, Anakin felt as if Palpatine was an additional mentor. Not as directly as Obi-Wan, of course, but offering solid and important advice. More than that, though, Anakin always felt as if he was welcome here.
I will talk to her, Palpatine agreed, upon hearing Anakin's request that he speak with Padme about leaving Coruscant for the relative safety of Naboo. Senator Amidala will not refuse an executive order. I know her well enough to assure you of that.
Thank you, Your Excellency.
And so, my young Padawan, they have finally given you an assignment,
the Chancellor said with a wide and warm smile, the way a father might talk to a son.
Your patience has paid off.
Your guidance more than my patience, Anakin replied.
I doubt my patience would have held had it not been for your assurances that my Jedi Masters were watching me, and that they would trust me with some important duties before too long.
Palpatine nodded and smiled.
You don't need guidance, Anakin, he said. In time, you will learn to trust your feelings. Then you will be invincible. I have said it many times. You are the most gifted Jedi I have ever met.
Thank you, Your Excellency, Anakin replied coolly, though in truth, he had to consciously stop himself from trembling. Hearing such a compliment from one who did not understand, like from his mother, was much different than hearing it from Palpatine, the Supreme Chancellor of the Republic. This was an accomplished man, more accomplished perhaps than anyone else in all the galaxy. He was not an underling of Yoda or Mace Windu. Anakin understood that a man like Palpatine would not throw out such compliments if he did not believe them.
I see you becoming the greatest of all the Jedi, Anakin, Palpatine went on. Even more powerful than Master Yoda.
Anakin hoped his legs wouldn't simply buckle beneath him. He could hardly believe the words, and yet a part of him did believe them.
There was a strength within him, a power beyond the limits the Jedi seemed to place upon him and upon themselves. Anakin sensed that clearly. He knew that Obi-Wan didn't understand, and that was his biggest frustration with his master. To Anakin's thinking, Obi-Wan's leash was far too short. He had no idea of how he might answer Palpatine's continuing compliments, so he just stood in the center of the room and smiled for a bit, while the Chancellor stood by the window, looking out at the endless streams of Coruscant traffic. After many moments had passed, Anakin worked up the courage to move around the desk and join him, following the Supreme Chancellor's gaze up at the traffic lanes. "I'm concerned for my Padawan," Obi-Wan Kenobi said to Yoda and Mace Windu, as the three walked along the corridors of the Jedi Temple. "He's not ready to be given this assignment on his own."
"The Council is confident in this decision, Obi-Wan,"
Yoda said.
"The boy has exceptional skills," Mace agreed.
"But he still has much to learn, Master," Obi-Wan explained. "His skills have made him, well, arrogant."
"Yes, yes,"
Yoda agreed.
"It's a flaw more and more common among Jedi. Too sure of themselves they are. Even the older, more experienced Jedi."
Obi-Wan considered the words with an assenting nod. They certainly rang true, and the current conditions among the Jedi in this time of mounting tension were a bit unsettling, with many off on their own, far from Coruscant. And had not arrogance played a major role in Count Dooku's decision to depart the Order and the Republic?
"Remember, Obi-Wan," Mace remarked, "if the prophecy is true, your apprentice is the only one who can bring the Force into balance."
How could Obi-Wan ever forget that little fact? Qui-Gon had been the first to see it, the first to predict that Anakin would be the one to fulfill the prophecy. What Qui-Gon, or anyone else for that matter, had failed to explain was exactly what bringing balance to the Force might mean. "If he follows the right path," the Jedi Knight said to the two masters. And neither of them corrected him.
"Attend to your own duties, you must,"
Yoda reminded, drawing Obi-Wan from his distracting contemplation as surely as if he was reading the Jedi's mind.
"When solved is this mystery of the assassin, other riddles might be answered."
"Yes, Master," Obi-Wan replied, and he held the small dart he had taken from the dead Claudite up before his eyes. With gentle hands, Shmi Skywalker Lars lifted the dull gold chest piece up to the wiry droid, setting it in place. She smiled at C-3PO, and though his face could not similarly twist, she could tell that he too, in that curious droid-like way, was pleased. How often he had complained about the sand blowing into his wiring, chipping away at the silicon coverings, even breaking through and causing jarring jolts on a couple of occasions. And now Shmi was taking care of that problem, was finishing what Anakin had started in building the droid. "Now?" she managed to ask aloud, through lips caked with dried blood. No, she realized, it was not now. She had covered C-3PO those days ago, or was it weeks ago, or even years ago, when Kleeg had taken her to the moisture farm. Yes, there were spare coverings to fit the protocol droid in the garage area, against the wall, under an old workbench. She remembered that so clearly, but she had no idea of when it had been. And now she was somewhere. She couldn't open her eyes to look around. She didn't have the strength at that moment, and the blood on them had dried, making any flutter of her eyelids painful. She thought it curious that her eyelids were the only place where she actually felt any real pain at that moment. She thought she was injured. She thought. Shmi heard something behind her, shuffling footsteps, then some mumbling. Yes, they were always mumbling. Her thoughts went back to C-3PO. Poor 3PO, who still needed his battered, wiry arms covered. Gently, she lifted the covering. She heard a sharp sound, or she knew it was a sharp sound, though she heard it only distantly, then felt a brush across her back. There were no nerves left there to register the bite of the whip any more clearly than that. Chapter 10. Anakin Skywalker and Jar Jar Binks stood at the door separating Padme's bedroom from the anteroom, where Anakin and Obi-Wan had kept watch the night before. Looking through the room to the broken window, the pair watched the Coruscant skyline, the endless lines of traffic. Padme and her handmaiden Dorme rushed about the bedroom, throwing the luggage together, and from her sharp movements, both Anakin and Jar Jar knew that they would do well to keep a fair distance from the upset and angry young senator. As the Jedi had requested, Chancellor Palpatine had intervened to bid Padme to return to Naboo. She was complying, but that did not mean that she was happy about it. With a profound sigh, Padme stood straight, one hand on her lower back, which ached from all the bending. She sighed again and moved before the two observers. "I'm taking an extended leave of absence," she said to Jar Jar, her voice thick and somber, as if she was hoping to inject some of that gravity into the goofy Gungan. "It will be your responsibility to take my place in the Senate. Representative Binks, I know I can count on you."
"Misa honored,"
Jar Jar blurted in reply, standing at attention, except that his head was wagging and his ears were flopping. One could dress a Gungan up like a dignitary, but such a creature's nature was not so easily changed. "What?" Padme's voice was stern and showed more than a little exasperation. She was entrusting something important to Jar Jar and was obviously not thrilled to hear him acting like his old goofy self. Obviously embarrassed, Jar Jar cleared his throat and stood a bit straighter.
"Misa honored to be taken on this a heavy burden. Misa accept this with muy humility and,
"Jar Jar, I don't wish to hold you up," Padme interrupted. "I'm sure you have a great deal to do."
"Of course, milady."
With a great bow, as if trying to use pretense to cover up the fact that he was blushing like a Dorellian fire crab, the Gungan turned and left, flashing a bright smile Anakin's way as he passed. Anakin's eyes followed the retreating Gungan, but any levity or sense of calm he felt from that last exchange was washed away a moment later, when Padme addressed him in a tone that reminded him that she was not in the best of moods. "I do not like this idea of hiding," she said emphatically. "Don't worry. Now that the Council has ordered an investigation, it won't take Master Obi-Wan long to find out who hired that bounty hunter. We should have done that from the beginning. It's better to take the offensive against such a threat, to find out the source rather than try to react to the situation." He meant to go on, to claim credit for asking for such an investigation from the very beginning, to let Padme know that he had been right all along, and that it had taken the Council long enough to come around to his way of thinking. He could see, though, that her eyes were already beginning to glaze over, so he quieted and let her speak. "And while your master investigates, I have to hide away." "That would be most prudent, yes." Padme gave a little sigh of frustration. "I haven't worked for a year to defeat the Military Creation Act, not to be here when its fate is decided. Sometimes we have to let go of our pride and do what is requested of us," Anakin replied. A rather unconvincing statement coming from him, and he knew as soon as he spoke the word that he probably shouldn't have phrased things quite like that.
"Pride?"
came the roaring response. "Annie, you're young and you don't have a very firm grip on politics. I suggest you reserve your opinions for some other time." "Sorry, m'lady, I was only trying to..."
"Annie, no!
Please don't call me that."
"What?"
"Annie. Please don't call me Annie." "I've always called you that. It's your name, isn't it?"
"My name is Anakin," the young Jedi said calmly, his jaw firm, his eyes strong.
"When you say Annie, it's like I'm still a little boy. And I'm not." Padme paused and looked him over, head to toe, nodding as she took the sight of him in completely. He could see sincerity on her face as she nodded her agreement, and her tone, too, became one of more respect.
"I'm sorry, Anakin. It's impossible to deny that you've grown up."
There was something in the way she said that, Anakin sensed. Some suggestion, some recognition from Padme that he was indeed a man now. And perhaps
A handsome one at that. That, combined with the little smile she flashed him, had him a bit flushed and put him back up on his heels. He found an ornament sitting on a shelf to the side then, and using the force, picked it up, letting it hover above his fingers, needing the distraction. Still, he had to clear his throat to cover his embarrassment, for he was afraid that his voice would break apart, as he admitted, Master Obi-Wan manages not to see it. He criticizes my every move, as if I was still a child. He didn't listen to me when I insisted that we go in search of the source of the assassination.
Mentors have a way of seeing more of our faults than we would like, Padme agreed. It's the only way we grow. With a thought, Anakin used the force to lift the little globe ornament higher into the air, manipulating it all about.
Don't get me wrong, he remarked. Obi-Wan is a great mentor, as wise as Master Yoda and as powerful as Master Windu. I'm truly thankful to be his learner. Only,
he paused and shook his head, looking for the words. Only, although I'm a Padawan learner, in some ways, in a lot of ways, I'm ahead of him. I'm ready for the trials. I know I am. He knows it, too. He feels I'm too unpredictable. Other Jedi my age have gone through the trials and made it. I know I started my training late, but he won't let me move on.
Padme's expression grew curious, and Anakin could well understand her puzzlement, for he, too, was surprised at how openly he was speaking, critically of Obi-Wan. He thought that he should stop right there, and silently berated himself. But then Padme said, with all sympathy, that must be frustrating.
It's worse, Anakin cried in response, willingly diving into that warm place.
He's overly critical, he never listens, he just doesn't understand, it's not fair.
He would have gone on and on, but Padme began to laugh, and that stopped Anakin as surely as a slap across the face.
I'm sorry, she said through her giggles. You sounded exactly like that little boy I once knew, when he didn't get his way.
I'm not whining.
I'm not.
Across the room, Dorme, too, began to chuckle.
I didn't say it to hurt you, Padme explained. Anakin took a deep breath, then blew it all out of him, his shoulders visibly relaxing.
I know. He seemed so pitiable then. Not pitiful, but just like a lost little soul.
Padme couldn't resist. She walked over to him and lifted her hand to gently stroke his cheek.
Anakin. For the first time since they had been reunited, Padme truly looked into the blue eyes of the young Padawan, locked stares with him so that they each could see beneath the surface, so that they each could view the other's heart. It was a fleeting moment, made so by Padme's common sense. She quickly altered the mood with a sincere but light-hearted request.
Don't try to grow up too fast.
I am grown up, Anakin replied.
You said it yourself.
He finished by making his reply into something suggestive, as he looked deeply into Padme's beautiful brown eyes again, this time even more intensely, more passionately.
Please don't look at me like that, she said, turning away.
Why not?
Because I can see what you're thinking.
Anakin broke the tension, or tried to, with a laugh.
Oh, so you have Jedi powers too.
Padme looked past the young Padawan for a moment, glimpsing Dorme, who was watching with obvious concern and not even trying to hide her interest anymore. And Padme understood that concern, given the strange and unexpected road this conversation had taken. She looked squarely at Anakin again and said, with no room for debate,
It makes me feel uncomfortable.
Anakin relented and looked away. Sorry, m'lady, he said professionally, and he stepped back, allowing her to resume her packing, just the bodyguard again. But he wasn't. Padme knew. No matter how much she wished it were true, it were true. On a water-washed, wind-lashed world, far to the most remote edges of the Outer Rim, a father and his son sat on a skirt of shining black metal, watching carefully in the few somewhat calm pools created by the current swirling about the gigantic caryatid that climbed out of the turbulent ocean. The rain had let up a bit, a rare occasion in this watery place, allowing for some calm surface area at least. And the pair stared hard, searching for the meter-long dark silhouettes of roller fish. They were on the lowest skirt of one of the great pillars that supported Topoka City, the greatest city on all of Kamino, a place of sleek structures all rounded to deflect the continual wind, rather than flat-faced to battle against it. Kamino had been designed, or upgraded at least, by many of the best architects the galaxy could offer, who understood well that the best way to battle planetary elements was to subtly dodge them. Towering, transparent steel windows looked out from every portal. The father, Django, often wondered why the Kaminoans, tall and thin, pasty white creatures with huge almond-shaped eyes set in oblong heads on necks as long as his arm, wanted so many windows. What was there to see on this violent world other than rolling waters and nearly constant downpours? Still, even Kamino had its better moments. It was all relative, Django supposed. Thus, when he saw that it was not raining very hard, he had taken his boy outside. Django tapped his son on the shoulder and nodded toward one of the quiet eddies, and the younger one, his face showing all the exuberance of a 10-year-old boy, lifted his pocker, an ion burst-powered atlatl, and took deadly aim. He didn't use the laser sighting unit, which automatically adjusted for watery refraction. No, this kill was to be a test of his skill alone. He exhaled deeply, as his father had taught him, using the technique to go perfectly steady, and then, as the prey turned sidelong, he snapped his arm forward, throwing the missile. Barely a meter from the boy's extended hand, the back of the missile glowed briefly, a sudden and short burst of power that shot it off like a blaster bolt, knifing through the water and taking the fish in the side, its barbed head driving through. With a shout of joy, the boy twisted the atlatl handle, locking the nearly invisible but tremendously strong line, and then, when the fish squirmed away enough to pull the line taut, the boy slowly and deliberately turned the handle, reeling in his catch.
"Well done," Django congratulated. "But if you had hit it a centimeter forward, you would have skewered the primary muscle, just below the gill, and rendered it completely helpless."
The boy nodded, unperturbed that his father, his mentor, could always find fault, even in success. The boy knew that his beloved father did so only because it forced him to strive for perfection. And in a dangerous galaxy, perfection allowed for survival. The boy loved his father even more, for caring enough to criticize. Django went tense suddenly, sensing a movement nearby, a footfall perhaps, or just a smell, something to tell the finely attuned bounty hunter that he and his boy were not alone. There weren't many enemies to be found on Kamino, except far out in the watery wastes, where giant tentacled creatures roamed. Here, there was little life above the water, other than the Kaminoans themselves, and so Django wasn't surprised when he saw that the newcomer was one of them. Ton Hui, his usual contact with the Kaminoans.
"Greetings, Master Django," the tall, lithe creature said, holding up a slim arm and hand in a gesture of peace and friendship.
Django nodded but didn't smile. Why had Ton Hui come out here? The Kaminoans were hardly ever out of their city of globes. And why would she interrupt Django when he was with his son?
"You have been scarce within the sector of late," Ton Hui remarked.
"Better things to do."
"With your child?"
In response, Django looked over at the boy, who was lining up another roller fish. Or at least he was appearing to, Django recognized. And the insight brought a knowing nod of satisfaction to the crusty bounty hunter. He had taught his son well the art of deception and deflection, of appearing to do one thing while in reality doing something quite different. Like listening in on the conversation, measuring Ton Hui's every word.
"The 10th anniversary approaches," the Kaminoan explained.
Django turned back to her with a sour expression.
"You think I don't know Boba's birthday?"
If Ton Hui was fazed at all by the sharp retort, the delicately featured Kaminoan didn't show it.
"We are ready to begin again."
Django looked back at Boba, one of his thousands of children, but the only one who was a perfect clone, an exact replica, with no genetic manipulation to make him more obedient. And the only one who hadn't been artificially aged. The group that had been created beside Boba had all reached maturity now,
were adult warriors in perfect health. Jango had thought that policy of accelerating the aging process a mistake. Wasn't experience as much a part of attaining warrior skill as genetics? But he hadn't complained openly to the Kaminoans about it. He had been hired to do a job, to serve as the source, and questioning the process wasn't in his job description. Ton Wee cocked her head a bit to the side, eyes blinking slowly. Jango recognized her expression as curiosity, and it nearly brought a chuckle bubbling to his lips. The Kaminoans were much more alike than were humans, especially humans from different planets. Perhaps their singular concept, their commonness within their own species, was a part of their typical reproductive process, which now included a fair amount of genetic manipulation, if not outright cloning. As a society, they were practically of one mind and one heart. Ton Wee seemed genuinely perplexed, and so she was, to see a human with so little apparent regard for other humans, clones or not. Of course, hadn't the Kaminoans just created an army for the Republic? There wouldn't be wars without some disagreement, now would there? But that, too, held little interest for Jango. He was a solitary bounty hunter, a recluse, or he would have been, if not for Boba. Jango didn't care a whit about politics or war or this army of his clones. If every one of them was slaughtered, then so be it. He had no attachment to any. He looked to the side as he considered that. To any except for Boba, of course. Other than that, though, this was just a job. Well-paying and easy enough. Financially, he couldn't have asked for more. But more importantly, only the Kaminoans could have given him Boba. Not just a son, but an exact replica. Boba would give Jango the pleasure of seeing all that he might have become had he grown up with a loving and caring father, a mentor who cared enough to criticize, to force him to perfection. He was as good as it got concerning bounty hunters, concerning warriors, but he had no doubt that Boba, bred and trained for perfection, would far outshine him to become one of the greatest warriors the galaxy had ever known. This, then, was Jango Fett's greatest reward, right here, sitting with the son, his young replica, sharing quiet moments. Quiet moments within the tumult that had been Jango Fett's entire life. Surviving the trials of the Outer Rim alone, practically from the day he learned to walk. Each trial had made him stronger, had made him more perfect, had honed the skills that he would now pass along to Boba. There was no one better in all the galaxy to teach his son. When Jango Fett wanted you caught, you were caught. When Jango Fett wanted you were dead. No, not when Jango wanted those things. This was never personal. The hunting, the killing, it was all a job. And among the most valuable of lessons Jango had learned early on was how to become dispassionate. Completely so. That was his greatest weapon. He looked at Ton Wee, then turned a grin at his son. Jango could be dispassionate, except for those times when he could spend time alone with Boba. With Boba, there was pride, and there was love, and Jango had to work constantly to keep both of those potential weaknesses at a minimum. While he loved his son dearly, because he loved his son dearly, Jango had been teaching him those same attributes of dispassion, even callousness, from his earliest days. "We will commence the process again as soon as you are ready," Ton Wee remarked, bringing Jango back from his contemplations.
"Don't you have enough of the material to do it without me?"
"Well, since you are here anyway, we would like you to be involved," Ton Wee said. "The original host is always the best choice."
Jango rolled his eyes at the thought of the needles and the probing. But he did nod his agreement. This was really an easy job, considering the rewards.
"Whenever you are ready."
Ton Wee bowed and turned and walked away.
"If you wait for that, you'll be waiting forever," Jango thought.
But he kept quiet. And again he turned to Boba, motioning for the boy to put his atlatl back to work.
"Because now I have all that I wanted," Jango mused.
watching Boba's fluid motions, his eyes darting about, searching for the next roller fish. The industrial sector of Coruscant held perhaps the greatest freight docks in all the galaxy, with a line of bulky transports coming in continually, huge floating cranes ready to meet them and unload the millions of tons of supplies necessary to keep alive the city planet, which long ago had become too populous to support itself through its own resources. The efficiency of these docks was nothing short of amazing, and yet the place was still tumultuous, and sometimes gridlocked by the sheer number of docking ships and floating cranes. This was also a place for living passengers, the peasantry of Coruscant, catching cheap rides on freighters outbound, thousands and thousands of people looking to escape the sheer frenzy that had become the world. Blended into that throng, Anakin and Padme walked along, dressed in simple brown tunics and breeches, the garb of outland refugees. They walked side by side to the shuttle exit as they approached the dock and walkway that would take them to one of the gigantic transports. Captain Typho, Dorme, and Obi-Wan stood waiting for them at that exit door. "Be safe, m'lady," Captain Typho said, with genuine concern. It was clear that he was not thrilled with allowing Padme out of his sight and control. He handed a pair of small luggage bags over to Anakin and gave a nod of confidence to the young Jedi. "Thank you, Captain," Padme replied, her voice thick with gratitude. "Take good care of Dorme. The threat will be on you two now." "He'll be safe with me," Dorme put in quickly. Padme smiled, appreciating the small attempt at levity. Then she embraced her handmaiden in a great and tight hug, squeezing all the tighter when she heard Dorme start to weep. "You'll be fine," Padme whispered into the other woman's ear. "It's not me, m'lady. I worry about you. What if they realize you've left the capital?" Padme moved back to arm's length and managed a smile as she looked over to Anakin. "Then my Jedi protector will have to prove how good he is." Dorme gave a nervous chuckle and wiped a tear from her eye as she smiled and nodded. Off to the side, Anakin held his smile within, deciding consciously to wear a posture that exuded confidence and control. But inside, he was thrilled to hear Padme's compliments coming his way. Obi-Wan shattered that warmth, pulling the young Padawan off to the side. "You stay on Naboo," the knight said. "Don't attract attention. Do absolutely nothing without checking in with me or the council." "Yes, master," Anakin answered obediently. But inside, he was churning, wanting to lash out at Obi-Wan. Do nothing, absolutely nothing, without checking in, without asking for permission? Hadn't he earned a bit more respect than that? Hadn't he proven himself a bit more resourceful? A Padawan to be trusted? "I will get to the bottom of this plot quickly, m'lady," he heard Obi-Wan say to Padme. Anakin seethed inwardly. Hadn't that been exactly the course he had suggested to his master when they had first been assigned to watch over the senator? "You'll be back here in no time," Obi-Wan assured her. "I will be most grateful for your speed, Master Jedi." Anakin didn't appreciate hearing Padme speak of any gratitude at all toward Obi-Wan. At least, he didn't want Padme to elevate Obi-Wan's importance in all of this above his own. "Time to go," he said, striding forward. "I know," Padme answered him, but she didn't seem pleased. Anakin reminded himself not to take it personally. Padme felt that her duty was here. She wasn't thrilled with running off planet, and she wasn't thrilled with having another of her dear handmaidens stepping into the line of fire in her stead, especially with images of dead Corday so fresh in her mind. Padme and Dorme shared another hug. Anakin took up the luggage and led the way off the speeder bus onto a landing where R2-D2 waited. "May the Force be with you," Obi-Wan said. "May the Force be with you, Master." Anakin meant every word of it. He wanted Obi-Wan to find out who was behind the assassination attempts, to make the galaxy safe for Padme once again. But he had to admit that he hoped it wouldn't happen too quickly. His duty now put him right beside the woman he loved, and he wouldn't be happy if this assignment proved a short one, if duty pulled him away from her yet again. "Suddenly, I'm afraid," Padme said to him as they walked away. heading toward the giant star freighter that would take them to Naboo. Behind the pair, R2-D2 rolled along, tootling cheerily.
This is my first assignment on my own.
I am too. Anakin turned about, taking Padme's gaze with his own, and grinned widely.
But don't worry, we've got R2 with us.
Back at the bus, waiting for it to take them back to the main city, the three left behind watched Anakin, Padme, and R2-D2 blend into the throng of the vast spaceport.
I hope he doesn't try anything foolish, Obi-Wan said.
The mere fact that he would speak so openly concerning his student showed Captain Typho how much the Jedi Knight had come to trust him.
I'd be more concerned about her doing something than him, Typho replied.
He shook his head, his expression serious. She's not one to follow orders. Like-minded traveling companions, Dorme observed. Obi-Wan and Typho turned to regard her, and Typho shook his head helplessly again. Obi-Wan didn't disagree with Dorme's assessment, however innocently she meant it. Padme Amidala was a stubborn one indeed, one of strong and independent thinking, and more than willing to trust her own judgment above that of others, whatever their position and experience. But of the pair who had just left the speeder bus, she wasn't the most headstrong. It was not a comforting thought.
Chapter 11. The Great Jedi Temple was a place of reflection and of hard training, and it was also a place of information. The Jedi were traditionally the keepers of the peace, and also of knowledge. Beneath their high ceilings, off the main corridor of the temple, stood the glass cubicles, the analysis rooms, filled with droids of various shapes and sizes and various purposes. Obi-Wan Kenobi was thinking of Anakin and Padme as he made his way through the temple. He wondered, not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, about the wisdom of sending Anakin off with the Senator. The eagerness with which the Padawan had embraced his new duty set off warning bells in Obi-Wan's head, but he had allowed it to go forth anyway, mostly because he knew that he'd be too busy following the leads he hoped he could garner here, uncovering the source of Amidala's troubles. The analysis cubicles were busy this day, as they were nearly every day, with students and masters alike, hard at their studies. Obi-Wan found one open cubicle with an SB-4 analysis droid, the type he needed. He sat down in front of the console, and the droid responded immediately, sliding open a tray.
Place the subject for analysis on the sensor tray, please, the droid's metallic voice said.
Obi-Wan was already moving, pulling forth the toxic dark that had killed the subcontracting bounty hunter. As soon as the tray receded, the screen before Obi-Wan lit up and began scrolling through a series of diagrams and streams of data. It's a toxic dot, the Jedi explained to the SB-4. I need to know where it came from and who made it.
One moment, please.
More diagrams rolled by, more reams of data scrolling, and then the screen paused, showing a somewhat similar dart. But it wasn't a match, and the scrolling started again. Images of the dart flashed up before Obi-Wan, superimposed with diagrams of similar objects. Nothing matched. The screen went blank. The tray slid back out.
As you can see on your screen, subject weapon does not exist in any known culture, SB-4
explained.
Markings cannot be identified. Probably self-made by a warrior not associated with any known culture. Stand away from the sensor tray, please.
Excuse me, could you try again, please?
There was no hiding the frustration in Obi-Wan's voice.
Master Jedi, our records are very thorough. They cover 80% of the galaxy. If I can't tell you where it came from, nobody can.
Obi-Wan picked up the dart, looked at the droid, and sighed, not so sure that he agreed with that particular assessment. Thanks for your assistance, he said. He wondered if SB-4s were equipped to understand the inflections of sarcasm. You may not be able to figure this out, but I think I know someone who might.
The odds do not suggest such a possibility,
SB-4 started to reply, and began rolling along with a dissertation about the completeness of its databanks, of its unequaled search capabilities of... It didn't matter, for Obi-Wan was long gone, walking briskly along the great corridor and out of the Jedi Temple. He left without a word to anyone, his thoughts turned inward, trying to find some focus. He needed these answers, and quickly. He knew that instinctively, but he had a nagging feeling that it wasn't necessarily about Senator Amidala's safety. He sensed that something more might be at stake here, though what it was, he could only guess. Anakin's mindset? A greater plot against the Republic? Or perhaps he was just being jumpy because the normally reliable SB-4 droid hadn't been able to help him at all. He needed answers, and conventional methods of obtaining them wouldn't suffice, apparently. But Obi-Wan Kenobi was not a conventional Jedi in many ways. Although he tended to be reserved, especially when dealing with his Padawan, his former master Qui-Gon Jinn had left a mark on Obi-Wan. He knew where to get his answers. He took a speeder to the business section of Coco Town, far from where he and Anakin had caught the would-be assassin. Obi-Wan stopped his vehicle and exited to the street. He moved to one small building, its windows foggy, its walls metallic and brightly painted. Lettering above the door named the place, and though he could not read that particular script, Obi-Wan knew well what it said. Dex's Diner. He smiled. He hadn't seen Dex in a long time. Far too long, he mused as he entered. The inside of the diner was fairly typical of the establishments, along the lower level, with booths set against the walls and many small freestanding circular tables surrounded by tall stools. There was a counter area as well, partly lined with stools and partly open. A variety of beings standing and leaning against it. A tough crowd indeed, Obi-Wan knew. Freighter drivers and dock workers, people who still use their muscles in a galaxy grown soft through technology. The Jedi moved to one small table, sliding onto its stool as a waitress droid wiped the table down with a rag.
Can I help you?
The droid asked. I'm looking for Dexter. The waitress droid made a rather unpleasant sound. Obi-Wan just smiled. I do need to speak with Dexter.
What do you want him for?
He's not in trouble, the Jedi assured her. It's personal. The droid stared at him for a short while, sizing him up. Then, with a shake of her head, she moved to the open serving hatch behind the counter.
Someone to see you, honey,
she said.
A Jedi, by the looks of him.
A huge head poked through the open hatchway almost immediately, accompanied by a line of gray steam. A wide smile on a mouth wide enough to swallow Obi-Wan's head whole, with huge block teeth, grew on the immense face as he set his gaze on the visitor.
Obi-Wan!
Hey, Dex, Obi-Wan replied, standing and moving to the counter.
Take a seat, old buddy. Be right with you.
Obi-Wan glanced around. The waitress droid had gone about her business, tending to other customers. He moved to a booth just to the side of the counter.
You want a cup of RDs?
The droid asked, her demeanor much more accommodating. Thank you. She moved off toward the counter, slipping aside as the infamous Dexter Jetster moved through the counter door, walking with a stiff gait. He was an impressive sort, a necklace mound of flesh, dwarfing most of the toughies who frequented his establishment. His great belly poked out beneath his grimy shirt and breeches. He was bald and sweaty, and though he had seen many years and did not move fluidly any longer, with too many old injuries slowing him, Dexter Jetster was obviously not a creature anyone wanted to fight, especially since he was possessed of four huge arms, each with a massive fist that could fully bust a man's face. Obi-Wan noted the many respectful glances that went his way as he moved to the booth.
Hey, old buddy.
Hey, Dex. Long time. With great effort, Dexter managed to squeeze himself into the seat opposite Obi-Wan. The waitress droid was back by then, setting two steaming mugs of RDs in front of the old friends.
So, my friend, what can I do for you?
Dexter asked. And it was obvious to Obi-Wan that Dex genuinely wanted to help. Obi-Wan was hardly surprised. He didn't always approve of Dexter's antics, of the seedy diner and the many fights, but he knew Dex to be among the most loyal of friends that anyone could ever ask for. Dex would crush the life out of an enemy, but would give his own life for someone he cared about. That was the code among the Star Wanderers, and one that Obi-Wan could truly appreciate.
In many, many ways, being here with Dex appealed to the Jedi Knight much more than the time he had to spend among the ruling elite. "You can tell me what this is," Obi-Wan answered. He put the dart on the table, watching Dex all the time, noting how the being quickly placed his mug back down, his eyes widening as he regarded the curious and distinctive item.
"Well, what do you know?"
Dex said quietly, as if he could hardly draw breath. He picked up the dart delicately, almost reverently, the weapon nearly disappearing within the folds of his fat fingers.
"I ain't seen one of these since I was prospecting on Subterro, beyond the Outer Rim."
"Do you know where it came from?" Dexter placed the dart down before Obi-Wan.
"This baby belongs to them cloners. What you got here is a Kamino saber dart."
"Kamino saber dart?" Obi-Wan echoed. "I wonder why it didn't show up in our analysis archive." Dex poked down at the dart with a stubby finger.
"It's these funny little cuts on the side that give it away," he explained. "Those analysis droids you got over there only focus on symbols, you know. I should think you Jedi have more respect for the difference between knowledge and wisdom."
"Well, Dex, if droids could think, there'd be none of us here, would there?" Obi-Wan answered with a laugh. The Jedi Knight sobered quickly, though, remembering the gravity of his mission. "Kamino. Doesn't sound familiar. Is it part of the Republic?"
"No, it's beyond the Outer Rim. I'd say about 12 parsecs outside the Rishi Maze, toward the south. It should be easy to find, even for those droids in your archive. These Kaminoans keep to themselves, mostly. They're cloners. Good ones, too."
Obi-Wan picked up the dart again, holding it between them, his elbow resting on the table. "Cloners?" he asked. "Are they friendly?"
"It depends."
"On what?" The Jedi looked past the dart as he asked, and the grin on Dexter's face gave him his answer before it was spoken aloud.
"On how good your manners are, and how big your pocketbook is."
Obi-Wan looked back at the saber dart, hardly surprised. Chapter 12. Senator Padme Amidala, formerly Queen Amidala of Naboo, certainly wasn't used to traveling in this manner. The freighter held one class, steerage, and in truth, it was nothing more than a cargo ship, with several great open holds more suitable to inanimate cargo than to living beings. The lighting was terrible and the smell was worse, though whether the odor came from the ship itself or the hordes of emigrants, beings of many, many species, Padme did not know. Nor did she care. In some ways, Padme was truly enjoying this voyage. She knew that she should be back on Coruscant, fighting the efforts to create a Republic army. But somehow, she felt relaxed here. Felt free. Free of responsibility. Free to just be Padme for a while, instead of Senator Amidala. Moments such as these were rare for her, and had been since she was a child. All of her life, it seemed, had been spent in public service. All of her focus had always been for the greater, the public good, with hardly any time ever being given just to Padme, to her needs and her desires. The senator didn't regret that reality of her life. She was proud of her accomplishments, but more than that even, she felt a profound sense of warmth, of community, of belonging to something greater than herself. Still, these moments when the responsibility was lifted were undeniably enjoyable. She looked over at Anakin, who was sleeping somewhat restlessly. She could see him now, not as a Jedi Padawan and her protector, but just as a young man, a handsome young man, and one whose actions repeatedly professed his love for her. A dangerous young man, to be sure. A Jedi who was thinking about things he should not. A man who was inevitably following the call of his heart above that of pragmatism and propriety. And all for her. Padme couldn't deny the attractiveness of that. She and Anakin were on similar roads of public service. She as a senator, he as a Jedi Padawan. But he was showing rebellion against the present course, or at least against the master who was leading him along the present course, as Padme never had.
But hadn't she wanted to? Hadn't Padme Amidala wanted to be just Padme? Once in a while, at least? She smiled widely and pointedly turned from Anakin, scanning the gloomy room for signs of her other companion. She finally spotted R2-D2 in a food line, where he stuck out among the throng of living creatures. Just before the droid, servers ladled up bowls of bland-looking mush, and each being who took one inevitably gave out a low groan of disapproval. Padme watched with amusement as one of the servers began yelling and waving his hand at R2-D2, motioning for the droid to move along.
"No droids in the food line," the server yelled. "Get out of here!"
R2 started past the counter, but stopped suddenly, and a hollow tube came forth from his utilitarian body, hovering over the buffet and sucking up some of the mush and placing it in a storage container for transport to his companions.
"Hey, no droids!" the server yelled again.
R2 took another fast gulp of the mush, reached out with a claw arm to grab a piece of bread, then turned and tootled and rushed away, the server shaking his fist and shouting behind him. The droid came fast across the wide floor, veering to avoid the many sweeping emigrants, making as straight a line as possible toward the beaming Padme.
"No. No,"
came a call beside her. It was Anakin.
"Mom, no."
Padme turned about quickly, to see that her companion was still asleep, but sweating and thrashing, obviously in the throes of some nightmare. "Anakin?" She gave him a little shake.
"No, Mom!"
he cried, pulling away from her, and she looked down to see his feet kicking, as if he was running away from something. "Anakin," Padme said again, more forcefully. She shook him again, harder. His blue eyes blinked open, and he looked about curiously before focusing on Padme.
"What?"
"You seem to be having a nightmare." Anakin continued to stare at her, his expression ranging from curiosity to concern. Padme took a bowl of mush and a piece of bread from R2-D2. "Are you hungry?" Anakin took the food as he sat up, rubbing a hand through his hair and shaking his head. "We went to hyperspace a while ago," she explained. "How long was I asleep?" Padme smiled at him, trying to comfort him. "You had a good nap," she answered. Anakin smoothed the front of his tunic and straightened himself, looking all around, trying to get his bearings. "I look forward to seeing Naboo again," he remarked, and he shifted, trying to orient himself. His expression soured as he looked down at the off-white mush, and he crinkled his nose, bending low to sniff it. "Naboo," he said again, looking back to Padme. "I've thought about it every day since I left. It's by far the most beautiful place I've ever seen." As he spoke, his eyes bored into her, taking her in deeply, and she blinked and averted her own gaze, unnerved. "It may not be as you remember it. Time changes perception." "Sometimes it does," Anakin agreed. And when Padme looked up to see that he was continuing to scrutinize her, she knew what he was talking about. "Sometimes for the better." "It must be difficult having sworn your life to the Jedi," she said, taking a different tack to pull his gaze off her. "Not being able to visit the places you like, or do the things you like, or be with the people I love." Anakin could easily see where she was leading him. "Are you allowed to love?" Padme asked bluntly. "I thought it was forbidden for a Jedi." "Attachment is forbidden," Anakin began, his voice dispassionate, as if he was reciting. "Possession is forbidden. Compassion, which I would define as unconditional love, is central to a Jedi's life. So you might say, we're encouraged to love."
"You have changed so much," Padme heard herself saying, and in a tone that seemed inappropriate to her, seemed to invite.
She blinked as Anakin turned her words back on her. "You haven't changed a bit. You're exactly the way I remember you in my dreams. I doubt if Naboo has changed much either."
"It hasn't."
Padme's voice was breathless. They were too close together, she knew that. She knew that she was in dangerous territory here, both for herself and for Anakin. He was a Padawan learner, a Jedi, and Jedi were not allowed. And what about her? What about all that she had worked so hard for all her adult life? What about the Senate
and the all-important vote against the creation of an army. If Padme got involved with a Jedi, the implications concerning her vote would become huge. The army, if one was created, would be made to stand beside the Jedi and their duties. And yet Padme would stand against that army. And so... It was all so complicated. But even more important than that, it was all so dangerous. She thought of her sister then, and their last conversation before Padme had flown back to Coruscant. She thought of Ryu and Pooja. "You were dreaming about your mother earlier," she remarked, needing to change the subject. She sat back, putting some distance between her and Anakin, gaining some margin of safety between them. "Weren't you?" Anakin leaned back and looked away, nodding slowly. "I left Tatooine so long ago. My memory of her is fading." He snapped his intense gaze back over Padme. "I don't want to lose that memory. I don't want to stop seeing her face." She started to say, "I know," and started to lift her hand to stroke his cheek, but she held back and let him continue. "I've been seeing her in my dreams. Vivid dreams. Scary dreams. I worry about her." "I'd be disappointed in you if you didn't," Padme answered him, her voice soft and full of sympathy. "You didn't leave her in the best of circumstances." Anakin winced, as if those words had hurt him. "But it was right that you left," Padme reminded him, taking his arm. She held his gaze with her own. "Your leaving was what your mother wanted for you, what she needed for you. The opportunity that Qui-Gon offered you gave her hope. That's what a parent needs for her child, to know that he, that you, had been given a chance at a better life." "But the dreams. You can't help but feel a little guilty about leaving, I suppose," Padme answered. And Anakin was shaking his head, as if she was missing the point. But she didn't believe that to be the case, so she continued. "It's only natural that you'd want your mother off Tatooine, out here with you, perhaps. Or on Naboo, or Coruscant, or someplace that you feel is safer and more beautiful." "Trust me, Anakin," she said softly, but intently, and she put her hand on his forearm again. "You did the right thing in going. For yourself, but more importantly, for your mother." Her expression, so full of compassion, so full of caring, was not one that Anakin Skywalker could argue against. The great port city of Theed was in many ways akin to Coruscant, with freighters and shuttles coming down from the skies in lines. Unlike Coruscant, though, this city on Naboo was soft in appearance, with few towering imposing skyscrapers of hard metal and shining transparasteel. The buildings here were of stone and many other materials, with rounded roof lines and delicate colors. Vines of all sorts were everywhere, crawling up the sides of the buildings, adding vibrancy and scents, adding comfort. Anakin and Padme lugged their bags across a familiar square, a place where they had seen battle a decade before against the droids of the Trade Federation. R2-D2 came behind them, rolling along easily, whistling a happy song, as if he were an extension of the comfortable aura of Theed. Padme kept covertly glancing at Anakin, noting the serenity on his face, the widening grin. "If I grew up here, I don't think I'd ever leave," Anakin remarked. Padme laughed. "I doubt that." "No, really. When I started my training, I was very homesick and very lonely. This city and my mom were the only pleasant things I had to think about." Padme's expression turned to one of curiosity and confusion. Anakin's time here had been spent mostly in deadly battle. Had he so obsessed about her, about Naboo, that even the bad memories paled against his warm feelings? "The problem was," Anakin went on, "the more I thought about my mom, the worse I felt. But I would feel better if I thought about Naboo and the palace." He didn't say it outright, but Padme knew that what he really meant was that he felt better when he thought about her, or at least that he would include her in those pleasant thoughts. "The way the palace shimmers in the sunlight, the way the air always smells of flowers, and the soft sound of the distant waterfalls," Padme added.
She could not deny the sincerity in Anakin's voice and in his words, and she found herself agreeing and embracing that truth of Naboo, despite her resolve to stay away from